This episode of Diaries of a Lodge Owner is brought to you by Lake Obabaka Lodge, a rustic luxury fishing lodge.
There was a ton of celebrities that were huge fans of the Oakland Raiders. And I remember getting a phone call once, someone on my cell phone saying, is this Craig Purcell? And I said, yeah. He said, can you stand by? I got someone who wanted to talk to you. And I get this call and they say, is this Craig? And I said, yes, it is. He goes, Craig, this is Tom Hanks. How you doing? Yeah, and he said, yeah, I'm in town on Sunday, and you know, I got the kids are with me, and you know, I grew up in Oakland, and blah, 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 blah. Do you have any passes? And sure enough, I got them some sideline passes, and it was just kind of a cool thing because you got to meet people.
This week on the Outdoor Journal Radio Podcast Network's Diaries of a Lodge Owner. It's been 5 seasons since I sold Chaudière, and it's about time I introduce you all to the man who bought it. He started in sales and worked his way up the corporate ladder to heights rarely achieved. You will be surprised by the awesomeness of his positions and the people who chased him down because of them. Yet the call of the wild in his heart was strong, and he came back to Ontario where he is building an outdoors empire. And it is my pleasure to introduce to all of you this outdoors mogul, Craig Purcell. On this show, we get a rare look into the life of a man whose corporate success exploded and once conquered, took on the northern tourism industry by storm. How our paths crossed, and a deep dive into where we are today. So if you're interested in success stories, love looking into the lives of truly interesting people, and are intrigued by the relationship of this former owner and the person I sold my baby to, don't go far. It's one of the best ones yet. Here's my conversation with Craig Purcell. Welcome to the show, Craig.
Glad to be here.
Yeah. So listen, you are now the owner of the Chaudière Lodge, which makes this a very interesting podcast, because I was the owner of the Chaudière Lodge as well. And when I got out of it, I sold the lodge to you, and we've maintained a wonderful relationship. I still have the island up there, and we're neighbors now. But I'm really interested, and I know a little bit about your past, but I've not actually had an opportunity to sit down and really drill down and find out who Craig Purcell was before Chaudière. So let's go back as far as your education in university college. Did you, what kind of education did you start with?
Yeah. And before we go there, I was just going to make one other point that when you bought the Chaudière, you and I were both looking at it at the same time.
That's right.
You saw it one day, I saw it the next day, and I was still down in the States, which I'll get into. And it wasn't the right time for me. It's not like you bought it out from under me, but like we were connected 10 years before you sold it to me. So,
and you actually had an offer in on Chaudière, because the way that story, worked out, and it's interesting. When I decided I was going to be a lodge owner, it happened at 2 o'clock in the morning while I was depressed because I hated my job, and I Googled and I didn't know what I was going to do. And, I was a sheet metal mechanic. A lot of you folks know that that's what I was prior to. And I come to the sad realization at that point, that's what I was going to be. I was going to be a sheet metal mechanic, and I was so depressed that I went on the internet at 2 o'clock in the morning one night, and I was searching northern properties for sale to buy a hunt camp for 20 grand up by Sudbury. And all of a sudden I hit Brian Dykstra's webpage. Yep. And Chaudière was one of the lodges that was for sale, but Lunge Lodge was the one that really kind of flipped the switch, because it was cheap
Well, it wasn't cheap, but it was, at the time, I think it had conditionally sold for $450,000 or something like that.
Yeah.
And so I got involved with Brian. And Brian kept steering me back to Chaudière, Chaudière, Chaudière. And the previous owner, Jerry Noel, he was running two corporations, an American corporation and a Canadian corporation, and was trying to do a share sale. And when I took all of that information to the lawyer in Orangeville, who gave me my free half an hour consultation, or lawyer or accountant or a combination of the two, when he looked at those books, he said to me, "Steve, do not touch this. You cannot buy this. It's, I'll tell you what, for me to forensically go through both of these corporations, it's going to cost you, I need a $20,000 rider to start." The guy, he knew I was crushed when I turned to walk out, and he, and his last words as I was walking out of the, out of that room were, "Okay, if you're going to attempt to buy this business, the only way that you can buy it is assets only." And then once I went back to Brian and said, "Hey, tell Jerry it's got to be an assets only and give me the best price." And then he come back 2 or 3 days later at like $750,000. And he was asking almost a million. And it was so quick that I didn't have my financing in place. And Brian called me a couple of days later saying, "Hey, Steve, sorry, there's another offer on the place. It's not firm. Don't get too worked up about it. But there's another offer on it." And I thought I had lost it. Well, that offer was from your group.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah, we were connected way back then. And
Brian's still a friend of both of ours. And I've probably bought, and so I bought a bunch of properties through Brian and lodges and stuff like that. So we'll get
into that too.
Yeah. So it goes a little deeper than that. But my background, I grew up in Toronto and, I was a typical kid that went to school to learn, but rather play sports. And I played hockey, ran track, and did all those things that we all like to do.
Yeah.
And then when I finished high school, one of the coaches from one of the other City of Toronto teams became the head coach at Centennial College. So I decided,
this is for hockey?
For hockey, yeah. So I decided, you know what? I'm going to go to college. I'm going to go to Centennial College. I went there. He only stayed for a year, but I went there for 3 years to play hockey and got a business degree. Basically, my background is it's a business commerce finance degree. It's like 3 years of a university degree.
Yeah.
Not as illustrious, but it gave me something. And the hockey kept me interested in staying there to get there and do the degree. Funny story, when I was going to college, I worked as a repo man for a leasing company. I would back in those days, didn't always have keys for cars and stuff. So what they do is they give me a list on a Friday afternoon and say, "Like, we got these 4 cars that have to be repossessed in the weekend." And I'd go out, and I was a bit of a car freak. I built hot rods and stuff. And we'd go from one car to the next. I'd steal the first car and drive it to the next location.
Get out of here.
Call the tow truck to come pick up that car. And I'd steal the next car and go to the next location, have the tow truck pick that up. And I'd always save the best car for last. So if there was like a Porsche 911 or a Rolls Royce or whatever, we did high-end cars. They did high-end cars. That was the car I was driving until Monday till I could go back and collect my $100 a car. So I'd go to hockey practice on a Saturday driving a 911, Porsche Turbo. And they'd say, "Like, who is this guy, man? He must be loaded." And like, no.
Yeah.
But for $150 a car, I'd make like $500-$600 on a weekend cash, which back in those days was
pretty
significant
dough.
And I started there. That's how I sort of got I worked there in the summer as an intern, just doing mailroom or something. So I left when I was finished college.
So now when you were going, when these cars were locked, were you like, you had a Jimmy the door open, Slim Jim? And
there wasn't as sophisticated with the technology then, right? There was no alarm. The bigger cars had alarms. But you'd take them and you'd Slim Jim them, and then you'd get in and you'd know what cars you're doing in advance, so you could get into the ignition and either cross it. If it was impossible to cross, you'd use a screwdriver, pound it in and go. I was stealing cars, but we own the cars. These are guys that hadn't paid for 6 months.
Legally stealing.
They were under order of seizure. So But yeah, it was interesting. And then did you ever
have any run-ins with the owners?
Oh yeah, no. I remember stealing a Rolls Royce off the bridle path, and the guy started shooting at me, and I just ducked.
No way! And I
had the key for that one. I just didn't know where the key went, I was in this car, and I couldn't find the key. And there was a little button on the dash, and it opened like a little window, and that's where you stuck the key in. So I finally figured out how to start the thing, and I fired it up, and I started driving between these two houses. I think I took the guy's screen door off. He came out, started shooting.
And, so he actually had a gun?
He had a gun. I don't even know who the guy is, and it's so long ago, I'm not going to incriminate myself. But he was a bit of a player. So at the end of the day, I got that car back. I brought that one right back to the shop because I figured, you know what, if there's some bullet holes or anything. He was just shooting above the car. He didn't shoot at the car because I think he didn't want to hurt the car.
Yeah.
But you couldn't do that stuff now. Like, you got to be a licensed bailiff. In fact, one of my guests is a registered bailiff, and I knew him from way back when. So there's way more paperwork and protocol now. But back in the day, yeah, he just showed up in somebody's driveway, took their car, brought it back.
That's awesome. Like I say.
Yeah, it was good. It was good money for a 19-year-old kid who's going to college. But and then when I finished college, I got a call from the guys that owned this leasing company, and they said, "Look, we just got bought out by a big bank, and we're going to start floor planning car dealerships." And really, what that meant was, you know, 40 years ago, Steve, if you wanted to lease a Toyota, there was no such thing as a Toyota lease or a Honda lease or a Nissan lease. They had to bring that paper or those loans back to Ford and Chrysler to finance them for them. And well, you know what happens then is that, you know, they get this customer in a Ford dealership, but why don't you buy a Ford instead? So we were the first bank that actually floor planned it. So what I did is I sold money to all these car dealerships. Steve walks into lease a Toyota Corolla. We pay the dealership for the car. Steve pays me for the vehicle lease payments. At the end of the lease, hey, Steve wants to upgrade his car. He wants to trade it in or he wants to buy it out. So we kept them involved, and that was kind of how we got started. So really what I did was I sold money to car dealerships, and my first year through there, they had said, look, you know, we're opening a branch in Ottawa. And I said, yeah, I heard Timmy's going to run that thing. And he said, yeah, well, Timmy told us today that when he went up there, the competition hired him right away. And I said, wow, that sucks. I mean, we're open to the branch on Monday. And he goes, well, you're open to the branch on Monday. And I said, what do you mean? He said, yeah, we're going to send you up to Ottawa. I'd never been to Ottawa before in my life.
Yeah.
So basically on a Friday afternoon, I found out I was moving to Ottawa. I went up there on a Sunday. And it was crazy because I didn't even have like toe rubbers for my dress shoes, right? Because there was no snow in Toronto. Ottawa was just seemed like an Arctic wasteland at the time.
Yeah.
And my boss took me up there. He first thing we did is we went to Bayshore Mall to buy some toe rubbers for my shoes because we had a foot of snow. And we're going down the escalator at Bayshore Shopping Mall, which is a big mall there. And I'm standing and looking back, talking to him. Well, I get to the bottom of the escalator. The escalator sucks my toe rubber in. So I'm basically on all fours, like in a sprinter position, trying to keep my leg from getting sucked into the escalator at the ground. The thing breaks. I go, you know, I roll about 15 feet, stand up. It takes the end of my toe rubber off. And that was my first, you know, 20 minutes in Ottawa. I said, this is going to be great. But what he did for me was, here's the scary part. When I was in Toronto, my first sales job, I took $300 a month draw. Not salary, not anything. It's draw, and you have to pay that back at the end of the month with your commissions. Well, I was like 3 months behind, $900, which now seems like a joke. But back then I thought, how am I ever going to get ahead of this game? Well, sure enough, I worked it hard. And as you started making more and more money, you started getting commission checks. And once I got commission checks, I was, you know, in love with the business. So he took me up there. I was paying $150 a month rent. He looked for places. He got me a place that was $2,000 a month rent. And I said, are you nuts? I can't afford this. He goes, don't worry. The company will pay first and last. You'll pay us back. You're going to make lots of money. And he put the fear of God into me, and I worked my tail off. I'd go back in the office at night, practicing my cold calls and writing my scripts. And before you knew it, I was doing really well in Ottawa as a branch manager. I had 4 or 5 staff. We were doing millions of dollars a month in sales, and life was great. And I really enjoyed it. And I did that for about 6-7 years. And then a buddy of mine that he worked for one of the governing sport bodies in Canada, which are all located in Ottawa. As you know, the Ottawa Senators came in 1992.
Yeah.
And he got a call from them and said, look, you know, we were looking for a marketing guy, and he got the job as sort of the head of marketing. And they were struggling in the beginning. There was no money, right? I mean, there was no secret that we paid $50 million for a franchise fee. We gave them $25 million. And then we had to pay another $25 million when we got the team. And it was a scramble. And, you know, one day he was in a meeting with the sales team, and the guy said, look, we got to get somebody who can sell. We got to bring some money in here. We've got lots of growing pains. We're a new franchise. And he goes, oh, my buddy's the best salesman in the country. You got to hire him and blah, blah, blah. And one thing led to another, got an interview, did a couple interviews. And sure enough, I started working with the franchise.
With the Senators.
The Senators in their
first year. Would that have been what, about 93?
92 was the year the team came. I came later in that year. And then,
you were later in 92, right on. Yeah, so you were basically there from the inception.
Yeah, I wasn't there from all the stuff you do leading up to launching a franchise, which I've done a few times. It's a lot of work, but I was there when the way they needed to generate revenue. And the way it worked, we were building a new building, and the way that you got your money is every time you sold a suite, you qualified for some more financing from the bank. It was almost like, you know, having a rental building and you got units rented out. So I really worked on the suite stuff and all their sponsorship, you know, media, radio, print, news, all that stuff. So I spent 10 seasons there. It was great. It was how I learned the business and how I got to understand the business. I was there in 96 when we opened that building, and at the time it was called the Correll Center. And like, I remember pulling plastic off the seats in January, getting ready for opening night. Like, we were all hands on deck. It was a small organization, but you know, everybody worked hard, and it was a great place to learn the business. And it's funny because we opened that building in 96. I read an article today in the newspaper about the five worst buildings in the NHL, and the Ottawa Senators building is in there because these buildings have like a 30-year shelf life. And once they're beyond 30 years, they're considered teardowns.
Yeah.
So kind of weird to hear that in a building that's that new, but you know, that's just the way it works.
Well, what is changing? Like, is it suites? Is it like what has made it the worst, one of the bottom five rinks?
I think the biggest challenge they have there, and you know, when we put the building up, and I don't want to speak on behalf of the guys that actually did all the work, but I, you know, I'm privy to some of how it happened, but we had to buy land, and you got to buy hundreds of acres to put a building that size up and all the parking lots and everything else.
Yeah.
So the only place you could buy land is to go out the border, the boundaries of the city. Yeah. So we bought land in farm fields. Like, some of the guys were knocking on doors and, you know, getting, you know, the farmers to sell us the land. And because we had to build there, and you know, even the overpass, we had to get the overpass built. We paid for the overpass to be built. And it had never been done before. Like, nobody had ever had to pay for an overpass, but because there was nothing there but our building, I think that's sort of what started. There was a million challenges, but you know, the guys worked hard. We had some smart people at the top, and they got it all done. You know, so the challenge they have now is that the building is a long way from the downtown core. So Steve and his buddies are in town for the night for a convention or for meetings or whatever. Hey, let's go to the Sens game. And if you're staying at a hotel, the Westin in the Byward Market, well, you can walk to the arena. You'd get a heck of a lot more people. And the issue is it's still a hall all the way out there. It's all built up out there now. It's all houses and everything else. But the challenge is most of the new facilities, I worked with the Oilers on their new building, and you make them a district. You put, you know, condos in there, you've got theaters in there, you've got entertainment in there, and then you've got your hockey arena. So it becomes part of an overall complex.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't make sense to do it where it is. There's some land in downtown that they've been trying to get a deal done for a long time. I know the previous owner tried to get it done. And I think when they do get downtown, it'll change everything for them. It's a big challenge, but they got the right people. They got the right owner in place now. And I think that, you know, he's probably a pretty aggressive guy. I don't know him personally, but I know that I know Cyril Leader and some of the guys that are still there. They'll make it happen. And I think that that'll change everything. So partly it's out there. It's not because the roof is caving in. It's partly because where it is and where it needs to be.
Gotcha. Yeah. Right on. So you worked for the Senators for 10 years and you learned the sport business and the marketing of sports.
Absolutely.
Go ahead. It's an awesome area to work in as far as a guy like me, a sports fan and all of that stuff. So where did that lead you?
Well, you know, I also ended up teaching sport management at Algonquin College in my last few years there. And I
When you were in Ottawa?
When I was in Ottawa. So I taught.
So you were a teacher?
I was a professor at Algonquin College, if you want to call me that. I call myself a teacher.
Professor Craig.
To be honest with you, I didn't even know I was getting paid. I know that the guy who ran the department one day said, hey, you got all these checks in your mailbox here. And I said, oh, what are they for? He goes, well, they're pay. I said, oh, I didn't even know I got paid to do this. So that was kind of fun. But what I found is that it was a sport management program, lots of smart kids in there. Some of the kids, I'm in touch with most of them still. A lot of them have gone on to really, you know, great jobs in sports. But I always used to tell these guys, I say, look, I know you want to be the GM or you want to be the head of marketing or you want to be the, you know, the VP of this or that or whatever. I said, but take my word. You'll never find an owner that'll say we've made too much money. Let's stop selling. So learn how to drive revenue before you start wanting to be something else. Because once you get their attention to do that, you'll get the opportunity to do other things. So
yeah,
I was always a sales guy. That's what I always wanted to be. And, so, you know, I'd done that for 10 years. I got a call from a headhunter in the States. And he said, look, I got your name from, it's in a pretty incestuous business. I got your name from somebody else.
Yeah.
And would you be interested in taking a job in the States? I said, well, you know, sure. Tell me about it. It was
in Minneapolis. And you're single at this point in your life.
I was single. Yeah. So, yeah. You know, a lot less decisions to make. The biggest concern for me was leaving my cottage behind because I love to go to my cottage. But I flew into Minneapolis. I met with the Minnesota Timberwolves. They're in the process of renovating their building, which is right downtown, the Target Center, which is right where Target's head office is in Minneapolis. And, you know, I started my own consulting business. So I formed CSP Sports, which is what owns all the lodges. And basically, I went there on a consulting contract, and I had some key accounts that they wanted me to target. But really what I went there to do was to, there were some projects that had to happen in the building. The issue they had with the NBA is nobody wanted to buy the suites behind the nets. They all wanted them, you know, from the end of the court to the other end of the court. No one wanted behind the net. Well, they had sat dormant forever. And I came up with a plan that said, look, why don't we turn this into a really exclusive club with restaurant and everything else? And they said, sure, find a way to get it paid for and get it done. So I found a company called Cambria, which is a Cambria Quartz company, a really interesting guy. He became a friend of mine. His family, he started Cambria Quartz. His family is the family that makes the cheese for Kraft Dinner.
So oh, really?
They got the contract to do that, and they have. They did the process to allow it to do that powdered stuff that you mix with Kraft Dinner that every kid still loves, and I'm sure I grew up on that stuff. So what ended up happening is I had them, we took all the suites, knocked all the walls out. We had them retrofitted because they wanted it to be exactly the way they wanted it to look. They paid for the renovation. They signed a title sponsorship on it. And then we had, I think, 184 seats or 144 seats in the club that you bought and you came and you had dinner and everything else. There were season tickets. We sold them out in days. So I took this vacant space that had never been sold to a revenue generating place with tickets, with a title sponsor, and fully renovated to the nines from a company that specializes in that stuff. And it was actually a pretty cool thing. It won the suites idea of the year in that association of people that manage suites and everything else. There's associations for everything. And then they started doing it in all kinds of places, but were the first.
I was just going to say, you can't go to a hockey arena or any other sporting arena. Well, football might be different, but any of these more intimate places without having that. You know, you got the Air Canada Club in Toronto that's behind the net. It's exactly that model. So I didn't know that you had a hand in designing that in the beginning.
Yeah, we were the first, and then they ended up, Cambria did a bunch of other clubs, and they wouldn't sponsor a team or a facility unless they had a club in it after what they did with us. Because they had tickets in there, they brought their key clients in there, all the builders, and use our product, and now they're a monstrous company. I mean, they're big now, you see them everywhere, but Marty Davis is the guy that runs it, and he lived not far from Minneapolis. We became friends, had dinner a lot of times, and he was a keen guy, and he was a tough negotiator, but he did a really good job. So we did that, and I spent two seasons in Minneapolis and loved it. Minneapolis is very, very similar to Northern Ontario because it's, you know, if you look at a map, Minneapolis is way up there.
Yeah.
They love the outdoors. They love fishing. They do all that stuff. We obviously, our lodges, we get a lot of guys from that area that come up. And I was 2 years in, and then I got a call from the same headhunter, and he said, look, because I did a contract once a year, once a year. I had to renew it that way to work in the States to get your T4. I'm not your yeah. T4, your
for the IRS. Permit.
Yep. And then he said, look, there's a chance, there's a job for you on the West Coast in California. And I said, wow, it sounds interesting. I said, who's it with? And he said, well, the Oakland Raiders. So I said, wow. I mean, I grew up watching that team. I knew yeah. Al Davis. I knew Freddie Biletnikoff and Jimmy Plunkett and all those guys. So I flew out to California, met with the Raiders. My contract was up in Minneapolis. And sure enough, I signed on with the Raiders as the senior vice president of sales and started working with them. And it was an interesting place. I mean, Oakland, California is an amazing state. I mean, it's got more people than Canada has. It's yeah. I think the economy is like the fifth largest economy in the world. It's insane. Wow. And I got a chance to work and I met Mr. Davis and he was like the nicest guy and loved the CFL, loved Canadians. And I started working with them and it was in the beginning, it was a bit of a tough sell because they should have been doing a lot better than they were. And I think that they had some roadblocks. One of them was that I can't remember if it was the Bloods or the Crips, but you couldn't wear an Oakland Raider jersey in a school in California.
Oh,
it was
yeah.
banned because they were gang colors at the time.
Yeah.
And that's not something that's common knowledge, not something I came up
yeah.
with.
How did you overcome that?
Well, it's tough to talk to a business and say, hey, listen, you know, Steve's Grocery Market, align your brand with the Oakland Raiders because it had a bit of a, it wasn't a negative thing,
stigma.
But it's just attached to it, right?
Yeah.
But what we did have there was a loyal following and they were fanatical Raider fans. They've been fans for life. And, so, you know, it was interesting because we ended up, you know, I remember I dealt with some of the local, GM dealers in town and that was, there was a year there where they were changing the model of the pickup trucks. And we said, look, we need to get something to get people in traffic. So what we did is we came up with a plan where no matter what make you have, if you take it into a GM store, you get a free oil change. So, and then we put it out in our social media, which at the time was an email blast because none of this yeah. stuff existed. But, and what we did is we put together a little package that if you bought a new truck, you got this Raider jacket and this and that and this bag of goodies. And, you know, the dealerships loved it because what happened is even if Steve's going in there to get his Toyota Tacoma oil change for free, he's in the front of the dealership walking around looking at this stuff. So maybe you don't sure. buy a truck. But by the way, we got the vehicle on the hoist. Steve, your brake lines are rusted in the back. Oh, okay. Yeah, put those in. So they did a really great job. They made a lot of money in the service side of it. They sold a lot of the trucks. And what it showed people was, look, our fans are loyal. You know, if we tell them to go in somewhere and look at something or take advantage of something, or you're a partner with the team, they'll reward you because they're, you know, you're a friend of the family, right?
Yeah.
So we started working that way. And then we started doing more and more promotions. And I did a big TV deal. And it was great because it was literally uncharted territory. They had lots of way. They have lots of room to move up. And we did a pretty good job of that. And like the merchandise, we had like, I think we had 18 stores in California selling Raider merchandise. Like even if the team was dead last in the league, they were still like third or fourth in merchandise sales just because it's so popular. And you know, you got to meet, I went on the road with Jimmy Plunkett and I got to know him well and Freddie Biletnikoff and
that's awesome.
You know, Marcus Allen, all these guys that were Raider legends, right? And Mr. Davis. And it was just a really cool experience for a kid from Toronto out there, you know, running the business side of the team. And I enjoyed it. I mean, it was, I knew I didn't want to be in California my whole life.
Yeah.
But I thought to myself, man, this is going to be great to spend a few years out here. And I did. And you know, it's interesting because, you get a bit starstruck when you're first in sports because you meet, you know, in Ottawa, like, hey, that's Alexi Ashen. That's Daniel Alfredson.
Yeah.
Well, they all became your buddies because you saw him every day, right? And it's not that you got over Daniel Alfredson, but, you know, he's a friend. You say, hey, Craig, how you doing, man? What are you doing? I'm going to go for a cop. Like they were just friends, right?
Sure.
They were superstars, but friends. In California, the same way with the players. But what I found out there was a ton of celebrities that were huge fans of the Oakland Raiders. And my job there was also putting on the game day. I remember my very first game, I met with ESPN. They said, look, we're going to start the game at like 1:07. We're going live. And if you're late with the anthem or any of your festivities before the game, there's a big fine, like $300,000 or 30 because they're 30-second spots that they miss, right? Yeah. So my first game, I had a guy singing the anthem. I can't remember. I think it was an American Idol winner or something, Ruben Studdard or whatever his name was.
Yeah.
I had a stealth bomber fly by, which was unbelievable for me. I couldn't
believe it. So you organized all of this.
I did all that. And nice. Watching my clock, having a mini stroke, and then sure enough, bang, right on time. They finished the anthem, the plane was gone, and we cut live. And it was just like, and I remember the president of the team coming down to me saying, man, you did this. This is all you. How do you feel? And I said, man, I got to be honest with you. I'm pretty jacked, because it was a big responsibility, but it was one that I just cherished. And it also enhanced my skill set, not just to sell. I was also looking after stuff that you know, went was outside my normal boundaries. So I enjoyed it.
Scope of work.
Absolutely. And it's funny because, you know, I also had this little teeny patch on the field. And what it was we had sideline passes. And if you're the president of GM or you're the, you know, the owner of ABC Furniture and you're a sponsor, you could call me up and we bring you and your son down in the field, Steve. And it was just a cool place to watch the guys warm up. Yeah. You have no idea how fast and big these guys are until you watch them scrimmaging or practicing in the catching balls, like a guy like Randy Moss running down the field. You know, the guy's like 6'19" and he flies like an eagle. Like it's unbelievable to watch it from there. But because I had the passes, I'd get phone calls from people out of the blue. And I remember getting a phone call once, someone on my cell phone saying, is this Craig Purcell? And I said, yeah. He said, can you stand by? You got someone who wanted to talk to you. And I'm thinking, this is long before, you know, scam telemarketers on the phone. And
sure.
And I get this call and I say, is this Craig? And I said, yes, it is. He goes, Craig, this is Tom Hanks. How you doing?
No shit.
Yeah. And he said, yeah, I'm in town on Sunday and, you know, I got the kids are with me and you know, I grew up in Oakland and blah, 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 blah. Do you have any passes? And sure enough, I got them some sideline passes and I met Ice-T and what is it? What's that guy with the bad pants? You know, I forget his name, but MC Hammer.
And oh, then, yeah.
And Snoop Dogg would call all the time and they'd bring a bus of people and stuff. And it was just kind of a cool thing because you got to meet people. I met a lot of TV stars because the Raiders were just sort of, you know, so if I was sort of, you know, starstruck, it wasn't necessarily the players. It was the people I met. Don't get me wrong. It was great seeing these players. I mean, a guy like Jimmy Plunkett that won the MVP and the guy wins the Heisman, he wins his two Super Bowls and he wins the MVP in the Super Bowls and he's still not in the Hall of Fame, but great, great player, great athletes. And I got to meet these guys and man, oh man, I wish we had FaceTime back then because I would have been texting my buddies to say, look, this is crazy. And like just fun stuff. And I remember the first night I got there and I had somebody said, like, you got to go to the Hilton tomorrow. You're going to help MC this thing we're going to have. And I walked into the Hilton and they had the radio panel, all the local sports DJs and stuff. And they were picking the Raiderettes for the year.
Yeah.
And there must have been 350 women in there. And
for
I said,
a young man, oh my God,
oh my God.
It must and have been like heaven.
I'm not going to get off topic here.
You can go as far off topic.
No, they were just beautiful women. There was like 300 beautiful women there. And yep. I said to myself, man, I just wish for 1 second my high school buddies were here for me just for 60 seconds and then I could zap them back because it was just sort of a cool thing. And you kind of got an idea for the interest in the brand. Really
sure.
Brand.
So were you involved in picking that whole squad as well? Like, was that
I was
part
involved,
of your-
but I wasn't the ultimate decision maker. But, you know, I didn't let the girls know that.
Yeah.
Of course I'm making the decision. What's your number again? I can't remember. Anyhow, no, I kept it business, I promise you, but it was a lot of fun and they were great girls, beautiful girls and they did a really good job and all athletic and it was cool. So my very first night I was in Oakland, there was an earthquake and it literally rolled me off the bed at the Hilton Hotel. I said, oh my God, what am I doing out here?
Really?
Yeah. It was a fairly sharp tremor. So it just went, it hit and then rolled and it just kind of rolled me right off the bed, but they were used to that out there. It happened all the time. So. But it was a cool place to be. Unfortunately, you know, Oakland moved from where they were when I was there. It's just the way things are. And the baseball team's moving. The basketball team moved across to San Francisco because just Oakland's just not a real big. It's not a big business town anymore. There's not a lot of head offices and stuff in there. It's a little tougher to get support, unfortunately. So. But it was great. I enjoyed my time there. I got to meet a lot of people. I got to meet Billy Beane, the Oakland A's.
Who was out of all of the people that you had the opportunity to meet, and you know, you've got all the celebs that were looking for the sideline access. Is there one that really stood out for great reasons or for terrible reasons?
You know, I think one of the fun ones that I met, I had the fortune of doing, when John Madden got inducted to the Hall of Fame, we had the guys, the commissioner came and some other people came, and I had the opportunity to work with him and do his sort of his Hall of Fame, not his induction speech, because he did that right at the Football Hall of Fame, but we did that at center field at the game, and I got to meet John Madden, and the guy's just like, he's just like one of your buddies you went out and had a beer with. And you wouldn't know that the guy was, I mean, he was a smart guy, don't get me wrong, but he just talked like we're having a beer sitting in the dock, Steve, and, you know, what are you doing tomorrow? Really? And that kind of thing. He was just a really great guy. And unfortunately, he passed away. It was funny, too, because John didn't like to fly, so he took his motorhome everywhere. So when you saw him doing a game in Denver on a Sunday afternoon, he probably left California like 3 days beforehand with his guy to drive him out there because he didn't like to fly. So he was really interesting. And you know, I got to spend some time, had dinner once with LL Cool J, and he was a pretty cool guy. And I felt like an idiot because I didn't know all the songs these guys played, right? Cause I just didn't grow up listening to that stuff, but they didn't care. They thought I had the coolest job on earth. So it's kind of funny when you hear a star, you get a star. I met Arnold Schwarzenegger about time and he's like, Craig, the coolest job on earth. And I said, hey, listen, you're the governor, man. I mean, you got a pretty good job, but it's not that they were envious, but they thought it was great, right? So, I got to
meet
him.
That's got to be a great feeling.
Yeah, it was when guys thought that what you had was the coolest thing on earth. When these guys are like successful gazillionaires, actors and rappers and this and that. And, you know, I got to meet Eddie Money. I spent a lot of time with him. Really cool dude. And the guy was like so interested in me. That's what I found was
really
that he was more interested in me. That, I mean, not to deny it wasn't him, but he was asking all the questions and you could tell that he was genuinely interested in you. He wasn't like, oh, hey, Craig, nice to meet you. And where you come from? And, you know, here's my five questions. I talk to every single fan that comes up to me. No, he was talking. I remember him. He wanted to go back to the beer tent. We had a beer tent when we went in there and had a beer with him. And he was a great guy. And his wife was a lovely lady. He had like 10 kids or 8 kids. He had a lot of family, but unfortunately he's passed, but I just got to meet some really, really cool people and it was fun. At the end of the day, it was something that I'll remember the rest of my life. I was there for a bunch of years. And then unfortunately my father passed away. He got cancer and I kept flying back to see him as often as I could. It's a long flight from California. I go every Sunday night after, take a red eye. Yeah. And we had a game on a Sunday. It was Friday. I talked to my mother and she said, look, he's not doing great, but he should be fine. And, I got a call later that day that he passed. And my mom said, just do the game, do your game and come back on Sunday. But I always regretted not being there for the last minutes of his life because I wanted to be.
Yeah. And, but you know what? That is something that you think about, but those last minutes are nothing compared to the great moments that you spend with that person throughout his lifetime, right? So
he was kind of delirious difficult. And stuff like he would he might not even know I was there, but it was interesting though, because you know, Steve, I'll tell you how I got back to Toronto, but I remember being back to Toronto when I left Oakland, and I remember going into this place. I stayed at my mom's place for a couple of weeks till I figured out where I was going to live. And I said, I got to get a haircut. Is that place, the Hairport, still open? My dad used to take me to this place all the time as a kid, right? And it was up the road. So I found out they're still open, but they moved somewhere else. And I walked in there one day and I recognized the guy right away. It was like Vito or Tony. It was a classic hairdresser guy, right?
Yeah, a barber, and an Italian barber.
And I said, my dad used to come in here. I used to come see you 20 years ago. My dad used to come in here all the time. And he said, what did your dad look like? I explained to what I did. He goes, well, tell me who what you do. And I told him I was this and that. I ran the team in Oakland. He goes, oh my God, your dad talked about you all the time. He was so proud of you. So
that's awesome.
He was in there and he was bragging about me. Right. So it was kind of cool.
Yeah.
So he was.
And why wouldn't he?
But even the nurses in the hospital, like he lost his hair because of his chemo and he had a Raider hat on and told everybody this hat, my son runs this team. So it was cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Very cool.
So, I wasn't there, but I think that, you know, he was proud of what I did.
For sure.
And, So and he would understand. He would have said, "Don't come back." Like, you know, whatever. Yeah. But that was a tough one. And funny enough, you know, I always said, "He's, you know, you got to take care of your mother." Blah 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 blah. And I said, "Yeah, of course." But I flew back from California, and I had a call from an agency, a headhunting agency, saying, "Look, there's an opportunity in Toronto, and we want to set up a call." And I set up the call, and it was a job. There's a company called Insight Sports, it was owned by Larry Tannenbaum, and Larry, as you know, he's the only, you know, private shareholder in the Leafs and the Raptors and yeah. FC and all that stuff. And this company created World Fishing Network, WFN, and it owned Game TV and Goal TV, which was a 24-hour soccer portal, and did a bunch of events. And they're looking for a president. So I did the interview on the phone. Larry flew me out to meet with him. Sat down with Larry, and that was
and
kind
you
of
we were still with the Raiders.
Still
at
with
this
the
point.
Raiders, yeah. Still with the Raiders, but knew that. Listen, if there was an opportunity like this, it took me back to my hometown.
Sure,
it would have been,
especially after your dad passing, and this gives you the opportunity to be closer to your mom.
Yeah, and come back home, and listen, I love California. Don't get me wrong. I knew I was going to live there forever, but I could have lived there longer, if you will. But Larry flew me out. Did another interview with the guys on the phone, met the other people at the business, blah, blah, blah. And then I thought we were done, and I wasn't going to hear, or I had the job or didn't have a job. And then he wanted to fly me back again. So I flew back again. And before he made the offer, he had a bunch more questions for me. And then sure enough, so they hired me to be the president there. And then I started working on all those properties. Yeah. And we had some great success with some of the stuff. There was some new stuff we were trying. That, you know, really was just trying to build up another piece of what he has. Cause Larry has so many businesses that he owns all the stops on the side of the highway. You know, every time you go to Barrie and you pull into one of those highway stops, he owns all those. He built
all
them
the,
all.
Like on the go or
yeah,
the,
yeah, yeah, yeah. The, whatever
on the run,
them. On the run, whatever they're called, the big stations in the side of the highway.
Yeah.
So he built all those, like he did all that. And, you know, remarkable guy, remarkable family. And, So you know, I worked for him for a bunch of years, and then we got to the point where, you know, he's a business guy, right? Like he used to own Two Bite Brownies, and he said, "Okay, it's making enough money. Let's sell it so we can, you know, we can turn a profit." He's a business guy, so sure. We started selling stuff off. We sold WFN off and some other things, and you know, there really wasn't as much for me to do there anymore. And one of the guys there that was basically the CEO. That brought me out there. Really, he's the one that set me up. Started his own business, and that's when I decided that, you know what, I'm going to keep consulting and do sports consulting. And I went to work with him, and you know, we did some fun stuff. We looked after some properties like Skate Canada and the Grand Slam Curlings, and we also created a TV show called Battle of the Blades, which was the hockey players and figure skaters.
Yeah.
So that was our show. The first year we did it in the old Maple Leaf Gardens when they had renovated it. Yeah. And we had Domi, Probert, and I think it was
And
Stefan.
It was the fight. It was the fighting, the battle. Or and no, Stefan, no, no. They were figure skaters.
They had to wear figure skates. And then we had, you know, I can't think of all the names. But so basically these hockey, macho hockey guys with these lovely, talented figure skaters. So they had to wear figure skates with, you know, with the picks and the toes and everything. So basically they became like choreography, you know, and you know what? It was CBC's top rated show that year. And I think the second year we sold the rights out, but I was part of that. It was kind of a fun experience. And I think the show went on for a bunch of years after that.
Yeah.
And then I just started, working on a bunch of different things on my own. And really from after working for Larry, that was kind of my last, I want to call it a steady paycheck, because everything else was being a sole proprietor. I was a consultant for everything. So I did a lot of work everywhere. I worked with a lot of teams in the US, in the NHL, the NFL, the NBA, baseball. I'd work with them on sort of revenue generation things, maybe looking at where they need to generate more revenue, where there was some shortfall. Yeah. And I also got calls from everybody and their brother that had something. I got this widget. I want to get a meeting with the teams in the NHL. So I'd facilitate the meetings. I'd give the guy a heads up. So like, he's got a new mobile app that whatever can sell tickets faster. Yeah. And again, you got to remember back then people weren't buying tickets on their phones and stuff. This was all new stuff, right? So
that's right.
Some of these guys didn't even have a website you could buy tickets on. So it was an evolving time. And I had guys that had all the software and technology to do that stuff. So all I did was take my Rolodex of guys that I knew for every single team, and I got paid to create. It was like
create relationships.
Basically, yeah. Steve, you got a product you want to sell to Chicago Blackhawks? I'll get you the meeting. You know, you pay me a retainer to get you these meetings, yeah. But I can't guarantee the guy's going to buy your widget that you know, yeah, makes people buy or whatever.
That's up to you. You need to sell your product.
You got to sell your product. And if it works, it works. I'll support you as best I can. But I'm not a software guy. I can't tell if your app's going to be able to process tickets or bonus points so people can claim it for merchandise. There's a billion things that people think that sport teams want. But at the end of the day, if they don't enhance a fan's experience or don't generate some new revenue streams for them,
they don't want them.
It's just like there's a lot on the go, right? So
yeah.
So, and back then it was a bit more wide open because a lot of that stuff wasn't happening. So I spent a bunch of years doing that. I think, you know, I worked for some teams specifically. I did some work for the Edmonton Oilers. I did some work with the Lakers and I spent a lot of time. I used to fly out every morning to New York and I'd do a meeting there with, the Jets and the Giants, then take a train to Washington, meet with the Capitals. And then fly to Miami and have a meeting with the Dolphins or something, and then take a red eye out to California because I had a meeting with the Lakers. Like, I spent a lot of time on planes.
Wow.
So I did that forever. And there was it came to a point where I said to myself, you know what? I don't really want, I was down in South Carolina with the consulting down there when my first daughter was born, and she was born in the States.
Yeah.
And I said to myself, you know what? This is great, but I've been there. I know this business, so I want to try something that I haven't done before, and I can always come back, just like you. Like if the world fell apart for you tomorrow, you can go back and do your sheet metal stuff because you didn't lose that skill set. It's just not what you wanted to pursue. But if you had to put bread on the table, you'd do it. That's just the way it works.
Back in 2016, Frank and I had a vision to amass the single largest database of muskie angling education material anywhere in the world.
Our dream was to harness the knowledge of this amazing community and share it with passionate anglers just like you.
Thus, the Ugly Pike podcast was born and quickly grew to become one of the top fishing podcasts in North America.
Step into the world of angling adventures and embrace the thrill of the catch with the Ugly Pike podcast. Join us on our quest to understand what makes us different as anglers and to uncover what it takes to go after the infamous fish of 10,000 casts.
The Ugly Pike podcast isn't just about fishing. It's about creating a tight-knit community of passionate anglers who share the same love for the sport. Through laughter, through camaraderie, and an unwavering spirit of adventure, this podcast will bring people together.
Subscribe now and never miss a moment of our angling adventures. Tight lines, everyone.
Find Ugly Pike now on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you get your podcasts.
Escape to the wilderness of Lake Obabaka Lodge, where the exclusivity of a fly-in meets the accessibility of a drive-to destination. Cast its pristine waters teeming with trophy lakers, northern pike, and smallmouth bass. Discover a paradise rich with history, offering serene moments and adventurous days. Lake Obabaka Lodge is where memories are hooked and history comes alive. Join us where the wilderness whispers your name.
So you had this wonderful business and doing work for some of the most interesting people in the world and meeting all of these people. What was the motivation that brought you back to Chaudière and I guess it wasn't Chaudière at first. Tell me a little bit about what was the motivation to bring you back here and to get you to go into the northern tourism business?
Well, to be honest with you, that motivation started a long time before I was even out of public school. Because when I was a kid, my dad's buddy had a little camp in Kawarthas on a place called Lovesick Lake. And yeah. I remember my dad and my brother and I and his buddy, Joe Nicholson, that owned the place. My dad would take us up and we'd open up the camp with him and, you know, chase the squirrels out and reconnect water lines and do all that stuff that you and I have done a million times and
yep.
part of the business. And then my dad would, you know, would go out fishing or something because, you know, for whatever reason, the regulations were different then. You could fish in like early May or whatever. And I remember going out with my dad and my brother, pitch black at night, no lights in the boat. We had a flashlight and they're catching fish. And I remember one time they caught like muskies back to back. And they're having a couple of beers in the boat and stuff, everything you could never do today.
Yeah.
And I just remember as a kid, it was the best time I got to spend with my dad. And I loved it. And, you know, it was something I said right then. I said, one of these days I'm going to have one of these lodges because I love what's happening. And unfortunately for me, when I finally got to the point that I was doing it, my father had already passed. But I never forgot the time. And I said, and you know what's funny, Steve, is I saw some people I worked with, the senators, you know, 20 years after I'd worked with them.
Yeah.
And I saw them in a parking lot one day. And they said, you know, what are you doing now? I said, well, I've got some lodges. And they said, I can't believe you actually did that. You've been talking about that for 20 years. And I said, really? Like, I didn't remember saying anything about it. I guess I just kept telling people that one of these days I'm going to do this. So my contract was up in South Carolina. My daughter was born. And I said, you know what? I'm going to find someplace back in Canada and I'm going to buy a lodge or resort or something. Now, at the same time, I was doing pretty well as a consultant. So I had to find a place that he's got a bit of a paycheck so I didn't go bankrupt. Because as we know, I made a lot more money and just like you probably made a lot more money in sponsorship and consulting than I did just purely from the lodge revenue. But it's a labor of love, right?
Yeah.
So I talked to our buddy Brian. And Brian, I knew I'd bought properties from him. I said, Brian, I'm coming back and I'm looking for something. And small world, there was a place available on Golden Lake. It wasn't a fishing lodge, but it had really strong financials. And Brian said, look, I can get you into this place. You're going to make money and, you know, do it for a couple of years. And make a long story short, I'd been going to Golden Lake. My high school girlfriend's parents had a resort on that lake. So I knew the place well.
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, it's got to be more to this coincidence. Maybe it's calling me. And I bought sands on Golden Lake. It wasn't a fishing lodge. In fact, the fishing wasn't really great in that lake, but it was a hotel. We did weddings and stuff. It was not a bad thing for me to learn because I learned more about hospitality than I'd ever learned before.
Sure.
And that was my first business. But, you know, I kept saying to Brian, listen, this is great, but at some point I want a fishing lodge. And I did that I owned the place for 5 years. And I think about my third year in, Steve, Brian and I came up to see you and I was the insurance adjuster or something is what we told everybody so I could go walk around the lodge.
Yeah, well, and for me, I didn't even know that I wanted to sell Chaudière until I was talking to Brian one day and it was in September. It was still in the middle of the season. I was in my truck going from A to B or doing whatever I was doing. And it was one of those days where, you know, you have great days, you have good days, and then you have days. I'm not ever going to say a bad day because at a northern resort, it's pretty tough to have a bad day. But it was one of those days that weren't great and weren't amazing. And I said to Brian, I said, Brian, if you can get me $1 million for this place, I'm out.
Yeah.
And Brian said, well, Steve, and you know how Brian, everybody knows how Brian talks. I've had him on the podcast, but you know, well, Steve, maybe we'll just take some time and we'll think about it and this and that. And I did. And I talked to Melissa, my wife, and we come to the thought or the idea that, yeah, you know what, maybe we should explore this. But I was scared to death to actually put it on the market because as a lodge owner, you always worry about what your guests are going to think. Right?
100%.
Are they going to come back? Are they, you know, how is this going to work? And so Brian and I kind of I said to Brian, I said, listen, buddy, I really don't want to put this on the market. If we can sell it and we can sell it at a what I feel is the right number. And we can do it quietly, then I'm in. And yes, you did come up as the insurance adjuster and I showed you around the lodge and the rest is history. So that brings us to the next chapter in our life. I became a former lodge owner and now you became a lodge owner. And tell me a little, let's talk about the challenges of taking over a business like that, because both you and I, although I took the Chaudière over and it was depressed. There was no revenue at all. Actually, I'm pretty sure that there were significant losses in the 3 years that I saw. But tell me some of the challenges in taking that business over.
Yeah. I mean, I think the same thing you thought is that you don't want to list it for sale because you don't want to lose the customers that may be coming up because they like you. And then at the same time is that as the purchaser, I've got all these people that like Steve and I'm the new guy, right? Is that you get judged on everything that happened before. And you know, it probably would have been easier for me if you were like a jerk and didn't do anything.
Well, that was my case. Yeah, I was telling people that, hey, I'm the new guy. I'm not Gary. Like
you had nowhere to go but up. And I just, what I had to do was maintain where we were and maintain that level of service. And listen, you know what? They've all been pretty good. You get the odd guy. Even to this day, Steve, I get a guy that says, oh, when Steve had it, we put twice as much bologna in the sandwiches. And I say, you know what? Sorry about that. It's an easy segue to say, if something's not working, well, you know, when Steve was here, that toilet always flushed properly or whatever. Because guys do that, right? Yeah. I think that we've done, you know, a pretty good job stepping in and maintaining it. And
well, I know you have.
Well, it's just, you know what it was is that in the beginning, you had a chance to take it from a dog's breakfast to a great lodge. I was a new guy and they're all saying, what are you going to do? Like, what are your plans? Right. So, you know, we bought the new boats and we did the bathrooms and I bought new beds and I spent money on stuff that you would have altered me to spending money on if you stayed there, but I did that. Yeah. And you know, it's funny because I had guys come back the next year and say, you know what? You said you're going to buy new boats and you did. So I put my money where my mouth was.
Yeah.
And you know, in our business, Steve, you can have 99 people that love you and one guy, no matter what you do, is not going to like you or going to give you a bad review. And I never get used to bad reviews, but you know what? You learn how to respond to them and fix the problem. But so it was a challenge for me because it was running efficiently and a good lodge. I simply tried to do what you were going to do next. Which is what I started working
on, you asked me on a number of occasions, hey, listen, if you were still here, what would you do?
Yeah.
And I appreciated that kind of interaction because, you know, it made me feel good about where I turned the business over to you. And, you know, when I first took over, I had to deal with a drought. And it was a very difficult thing to deal with, but you, my friend, when you took over that business, I think you might have got 1 year in that was normal.
Well, and the first year we had the flood. So
that's exactly right.
We were driving boats into the boathouse unloading.
That's right. I drove my Alaskan right into the boathouse.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was a massive flood.
Yeah. It was everywhere in Ontario and we had to build picnic tables to put them on top of the dock and valet one boat at a time. My entire dock crew till the end of June was wearing hip waders. It was crazy.
I know. And then on top of that, the following year was COVID.
Yeah, that was.
Tell me a little bit about how COVID affected your business and how did you deal with it?
Well, I mean, we all went through it, all the businesses in Ontario and Canada, I'm sure. It was tough because as you know, you automatically lost all the American guests.
Yeah.
They were gone.
And for multiple years.
Yeah. For 2 years. And I think even the year before you could still come, but you had to prove you had a vaccination. If you were an anti-vax, didn't want to do it, whatever. And you're one of a group of four guys. Oh, we're not coming. Steve won't get his vaccine. Right or wrong. Yeah. Believe it or not. That's what it meant is that we lost people. Yeah. So the positive thing from COVID is that people in Ontario couldn't travel. So we had guys coming to our lodge. Like if you look at my homepage, there's a drone video. That's a doctor from, I think, London or something like that took that video. He came up with his family. He said, look, we would never have come here. No offense. We're on our way to like Brazil or something, but they came up there and they had a good time.
Yeah.
So what it did was it took the onus on all American to having some Canadian regulars mixed with the Americans so that, you know, if it ever happened again or something happened at the border, it took a little bit of the pressure off, but man, oh man, you couldn't feed people in the dining room. So you had no Americans. You couldn't feed people in the dining room. And then we'd have to take, you know, these lovely meals, stick them in a plastic container, bring it to your door, and have you eat in your lap. Because as you know, our cabins don't have kitchens in them. They got tables and stuff, but not set up for a family of four or six or whatever. Yeah. So it wasn't the sort, like, I kept telling people, this isn't how it normally is, guys. You lose all the interaction a lot. You're not sitting around and talking at dinner. Hey, I caught a, you know, 7-pound walleye up here. What were you using? Like all that chatter, all the things that go on. You didn't have it. Like you didn't have any of that
stuff. Magic. That's the magic you're talking about.
It was a bunch of people staying in hotel rooms that came down to the dock to get their boats. And if you weren't there loading your boat at the same time, there was no communication. So it was tough because, you know, anybody that came there didn't come back because they didn't have a good time. I wouldn't necessarily blame them, but I'd be like, geez, guys, like if you'd gone to any other lodge, it was the same experience because we were stuck to do that. We're not allowed to serve people in dining rooms. So that year, it was tough financially. Like, you know, I said to myself, man, I went from the flood to the plague here. Like, what's next? Locusts? Like, I didn't know what was coming up. And I thought.
I know.
So, you know, we got through it. You know, I had to borrow a little bit of money to get through COVID. I'm still paying some of that back. And it's not something you budget for, right? It's the amount of money I had to borrow to COVID to keep everything going. I could have built this, like a new lodge or something. Like I could have done a lot of damage with that. I bored it to keep my staff employed and keep myself solvent. So, and I'm like a million lodge owners or thousands of lodge owners across Ontario now that are paying it back. It's a tough bill. Some of these people took money out that is equivalent to an entire year of net income. And now they have to pay that back. It means to go without income for a year. It's tough.
Yeah.
It's tough. So, you know, a lot of them
didn't make it.
No, like, they didn't. I
mean, Chaudière is in that Goldilocks zone where you had the good fortune of harvesting from the GTA.
Yeah.
Right. So that's an awful large body of people who could not travel that were looking to do something, anything. And they were willing to drive 4 hours north of the GTA, but definitely not willing to drive 13 hours north of the GTA or 20 hours, because all of those Northwestern businesses rely almost solely on the Americans coming across the border, because you've got Michigan, you've got all of those northern states that border Ontario all the way up. And all of those guys, they didn't have that GTA draw. So, you know, a lot of them didn't make it. And the ones that did, they suffered for sure.
And they're still paying for it financially, not from a service perspective. But, you know, listen, it happened to everybody. It is what it is. But, you know, again, it's just like, man, oh, man, like this is lodges are how I feed my family now. I don't do any sports consulting. So, you know, you learn how to juggle your bank account for a few years to get through it. And hopefully that never happens again to anybody, for any person in Canada, not just the lodge owners. But so it was tough. You know, we bounced back really well. Last year was our strongest year ever. You know, one of the best years ever for the lodge. And I think that, you know, continue to try to, you know, fix the things that need to be fixed, improve upon the things to be improved. We've got some plans this year. And as we've been talking about, you and I, all winter long, it's the craziest winter ever. The ice might be out there a month early this year, so I can actually get up.
It's crazy. You were just saying you were talking to Bud in Dalkeith.
Yeah, he said it's wide open up there. Like the top of the river there where our lodge is and your island is wide open. So, you know, it may sound crazy, but a week from now, I may be able to get up to the lodge. Earliest I've ever been in is like April 20th. And even then, it's like you're dodging icebergs. So, man, if we get up this early, I hope it doesn't hurt anything in the environment, but it is what it is, I guess. It's just one of those years.
Yeah, for sure. So, listen, I am going to make a statement, and I want you to react to it.
Okay.
And save Obabaka for the end. But the statement is, one isn't enough. What do you think about that?
I think that I've been trained through my consulting business to be able to manage different projects at different times and with different levels of investment in my time. And I think that I love lodges. I love real estate and I love the people that come up. And I think that the reason that I have multiple lodges is because I just think it's a fantastic business and I'm making lots of friends.
And let's talk about each one of them quickly.
Sure.
Like so I say, and leave Obabaka until the end.
Okay. So I just, and as you know, Steve, I've got a business partner, friend, that helped me. She's an accountant. She helped me out way back in the beginning with all my books and everything else. And a few years after I had Chaudière, there was an opportunity for another lodge in the French River on the Lower French. So French River Lodge became available and, I took her to see it and she said, look, let's buy it. I'll run it. And I said, okay, great. Because I said, you know, my focus is Chaudière and we ended up buying French River Lodge, which is a great little spot in the Lower French River. It we have Nipissing and it goes into Georgian Bay and it's a small, used to be American Plan. Now it's just a housekeeping resort, a much different business than Chaudière, much easier to run. I say easier to run. They all have their own challenges, but, there's no chef, there's no food, there's none of that stuff going on. And, it's been a great little property, had his 100th anniversary last year, has a fantastic old main lodge. It's a 2.5-story post and beam building. Really cool.
And the musky fishing down there is ridiculous. Their largemouth bass is awesome. There's walleye. It is a beautiful spot.
Yeah. It doesn't take a lot of pressure. So it's a great spot as well. And listen, I love the French River. 20 years before I ever got to the French River, just because I followed it on postcards and travel magazines and stuff. Yeah. So I loved it. So having the upper and lower covered off, I felt pretty fortunate. And having Jean there allowed me to do that without losing my focus on my primary lodge, which is Chaudière.
Wonderful. And then, so you've got that one.
Yeah.
What other resorts do you have?
So we have another property on Manitoulin Island called Red Lodge. And Red Lodge is more of a family resort, Steve. I think we have two rental boats there. I don't think they've ever been rented since we own the property. And we have a manager in there, but Gene, again, looks after that. I go up there for some heavy lifting. I'll help open up. This year we're doing some floor work and everything else. But Gene's the face. And I find that it's important that when you have a property – you've got that face that's there and they're the one that the guests know. And they just like you were and I am at Chaudière and she's the face there. We have a manager at French River Lodge as well, Keith, who's really the face of that lodge. He's been there. He was there 20 years before he bought it. So
imperative.
Yeah. And the guests don't come here and say, who's the new guy? I want to meet him. Sometimes they do. And we do meet him, but really it's where's Keith? Or when they go to Red Lodge, where's Gene? Or we go to Shod, where's Craig? Just like they used to say, where's Steve? And that's, that's important. I love I wish I could have 50 of them because I just love lodges, but you also realize you've got some bandwidth. And I think that the strategy for me has always been put somebody in place, or hopefully there's somebody in place now that is the face of the lodge and they're going to stay, because then all you do is improve upon the property. The guests love the improvement and the old standby guy is still there that they've known for 20 years.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Hi, everybody. I'm Angelo Viola.
And I'm Pete Bowman.
Now, you might know us as the hosts of Canada's favorite fishing show, but now we're hosting a podcast.
That's right. Every Thursday, Angelo and I will be right here in your ears, bringing you a brand new episode of Outdoor Journal Radio.
Now, what are we going to talk about for 2 hours every week?
Well, you know there's going to be a lot of fishing.
I knew exactly where those fish were going to be and how to catch them, and they were easy to catch.
Yeah, but it's not just a fishing show. We're going to be talking to people from all facets of the outdoors, from athletes.
All the other guys would go golfing. Me and Garth and Turk and all the Russians would go fishing.
To scientists.
But now that we're reforesting and letting things free, it's the perfect transmission environment for Lyme disease.
To chefs.
If any game isn't cooked properly,
marinated,
you will taste it.
And whoever else will pick up the phone.
Wherever you are, Outdoor Journal Radio seeks to answer the questions and tell the stories of all those who enjoy being outside.
Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As the world gets louder and louder, the lessons of our natural world become harder and harder to hear, but they are still available to those who know where to listen. I'm Jerry Ouellette, and I was honored to serve as Ontario's Minister of Natural Resources. However, my journey into the woods didn't come from politics. Rather, it came from my time in the bush and a mushroom. In 2015, I was introduced to the birch-hungry fungus known as chaga, a tree conch, with centuries of medicinal use by indigenous peoples all over the globe. After nearly a decade of harvest, use, testimonials, and research, my skepticism has faded to obsession, and I now spend my life dedicated to improving the lives of others through natural means. But that's not what the show's about. My pursuit of this strange mushroom and my passion for the outdoors has brought me to the places and around the people that are shaped by our natural world. On Outdoor Journal Radio's Under the Canopy podcast, I'm going to take you along with me to see the places and meet the people that will help you find your outdoor passion and help you live a life close to nature and under the canopy. Find Under the Canopy now on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you get your podcasts.
I know that I've mentioned Obabaca a couple of times, but do you have anything else on the go?
Yeah, I have a new one that we have that, again, it's a bit of a different stretch for me because it's nothing I've done before. And I purchased a place called Nestor Falls Flying Outposts. So we have two Cessnas, a beaver, and an otter up there. And really what it is an air base. And there's 14 outpost camps. And what it does is people show up at the base. We fly them out the outpost camps. It's all housekeeping. Then we bring them back in. And so really what it is amazing fishing with a great taxi service. And when I bought the place, the people that ran the place, not the owners, but the chief pilot, the operation guys, they're all still there. I talk to them all the time. And they run the business for me. I don't know how to fly. For selfish reasons, they're going to teach me how to fly.
That's great.
That business has been the guys that I bought it from, Dave and Michelle, had started that business from scratch 39 years ago. Done a hell of a job. It's a solid business. And it's just something that it's a different experience. I would say, Steve, there's a lodge that's about 99.9% U.S. guests. So yeah. There's a lodge that struggled during COVID because there was no business.
Yeah.
So that's a new one, but it's in good hands up there. And I look forward to learning more about that, but it's something that I never would have made a move like that unless I had the people in place to take care of it.
For sure. Wow. And you're covering, you're checking off all the boxes, eh? You got the fly in, base. You've got the lower French, which is the housekeeping. You've got Chaudière, which is, a full American plan. And then I want to talk a little bit about, Lake Obabaca Lodge. And that's another one of your properties. And I remember, when I first bought Chaudière, there's a couple that live on an island on the Upper French called Dead Man's Island, and his name, it's Gary and Kitty Roman, and they used to come over to Chaudière every night in the summer for about 2.5 months. They would come for dinner every night. And Gary was one of those guys. He was born in Detroit. Kitty was from Hong Kong, and they were just wonderful people. But Gary was particular on how he liked things, and he was always out to try and help me create a better product so he could enjoy it,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
And he would constantly refer to this lodge. And back then I had no idea. I didn't even take the time to look it up, but he would refer to this wonderful lodge and you should be more like Lake Obabaca Lodge. And, he told me that place, and Gary was, he was well off. He's actually, he grew the largest video library in the Orient, and then sold it to Blockbuster in the mid-90s. Yep. And he was always about And he knew these places. He traveled to a lot of the different lodges, but Obabaka Lake Lodge was the one that he constantly compared myself to. And then sure enough, after you bought Chaudière, maybe a year later, I started hearing this, the Obabaka or Lake Obabaka Lodge. And it is that. And that's another one of your properties. And I can't wait to see it. But tell us a little bit about the challenges and the awesomeness of this place. Like, it's got so much to offer between, and I'll just touch on a few points. It's all inclusive. It's very, very private. You have outpost lakes that you can go and spend day trips there. The history is ridiculous. Just hearing about it from you and a mutual friend of ours now, Scotty Hamp, he's been working for you. Scotty always would come up to Chaudière and help me out with the engines and you just kind of assimilated Scotty's talents into your model. But he's told me so much about it as well. And I'd love for you to talk a little bit about Obabaka.
Yeah. And it's funny because I know who you're talking about, Mr. Roman, and it's, I found an old rate card for that place. And you know, it's always funny. Someone sent me a rate card for Chaudière. It was like 50 cents a day back in 1936. And it's hilarious. You wonder how $2 a week people could make money, but the world was different then.
Yeah.
So I found a rate card from, I think, 1981 or 1980. And it was $350 a day per person. 1980.
Wow.
Can you imagine charging that kind of money now if you'd gone up in scale? So the place was built by a couple of guys from Austria and they had greenhouses there. They had flowers everywhere, orchids. Apparently it was magical. I don't have a green thumb and I don't have any orchids there, but I get told by a lot of guests that come up there and say, oh, you should see the flowers that used to be here. So to me, Obabaka is about as close as you're going to get to a fly-in that you can drive a car to, because we're at the end of a dead end road, on this lake that's about 28 miles long. And, it's a lake trout lake. You know, big pike, big bass, giant lake trout. And it's a cool spot.
Yeah.
It's not a big place to eat. There's only 7 cabins. The main lodge is a beautiful log building. And the cabins are all log and all the furniture is built right into the walls. Like, these guys were real amazing craftsmen. The ceiling in the games room, it would take me 3 years to do. It's just spectacular. And it's quiet. It's intimate. The lake has no traffic on it. There's only 8 cabins, I think, including us on the entire property.
Wow.
So it's a good spot.
With no access.
If you can't, anybody can get on the French River for any of the boat launches that are out there, which is fair.
That's
and fine.
Right.
But there are no boat launches on this lake. So we have a launch in our property and there's one launch next door where the guys that have an island use it. But so it's very limited access. They also shut down fishing for 20 years up there. Because somebody wanted, one of the previous owners of the lodge had asked them to do that. And so the fishery's insane. One of our guides, Marcel, who guides for us at Chaudière, he said, Craig, that place is polluted with fish. And that's how he guided up there. It's a good problem to have.
Spaghetti.
So yes. So, yeah. What I like about it, Steve, is that I can have breakfast at Chaudière with my guests. I can drive up there if they need something done or something fixed and be back for dinner. So so if I was going to do that and spread myself out, I wanted to be that I could be in both places at the same time. And it's a really cool spot. And, I just thought it's an intimate little place that has, and the challenge I had there is that it's been a private resort for 20 years. So nobody could have gone there for 20 years because it was first owned by a fellow out of Texas and then owned by a local guy. So when I bought it, much the same as when you bought Chaudière, I had a functioning property. I had no guests. So we're still building up the guests there because, guys that plan fishing trips, plan them years out, 2 years out, whatever. We're still picking up guests, but what we're finding is because we've got, 500 feet of beachfront, we do get a lot of families in there that don't necessarily focus on fishing, but they want a great meal. There's a beautiful bar there right on the side of the lake, and there's a big fire pit with chairs and stuff like that. So it's a cool place to take your buddies and go fishing, but it's also a place where you can bring the wife and kids and feel comfortable. And I mean, there's 22 white sand beaches in that. Like, you get up there, there's one beach that's a mile and a half long. You think you're in the middle of the Barbados. It's unbelievable. And then you've got, you know, 10-story rock faces. You got a fabulous fishery. You've got it's all the far end of the lake is all traditional Indian grounds. It's all grandfathered. There's trees there, the oldest trees in North America.
Talk about that. I remember. I think it was Nolan Newhook, a great buddy of mine.
Yeah. Who's now a friend of mine. I bought my last three cars from again.
That's
a guy,
right. That's right.
Know, I'm stealing all your friends.
You and Nolan
help me
up through the Ford dealership, and Nolan was telling me about the trees and some sort of hieroglyphs or something like that. There.
Yeah, they're everywhere along the water. There's rock faces where you'll see the pictures of them, and there's a sort of a map to all that stuff that you could actually go out and see when they were painted. At the far end of the lake, there's a pathway up to a lake at the very top, which is a lake that they've been doing this annual pilgrimage for thousands of years. It's Ojibwe, and it's a beautiful lake with a big rock wall on one side of it. And there's trails up through there. And in among those trails are these trees. They call them the Three Sisters, the biggest three. And they estimate that they're thousands of years old. They're massive. You know, take five guys to put your arms around them just to get them around the tree. And this stuff is untouched. I mean, when you have trees that are original growth, they've been that way for thousands of years. Yeah. So it's beautiful property, beautiful land. And it's all crown land. So the one thing you'll never see on there is a dock or a boathouse out in the part of the lake, because there's nobody on them. It's all owned by the government. And it'll never be built upon. So for me, it was a time capsule. And I thought, you know what? This place is protected by all the powers that be. I don't have to worry about it. And, you know,
well, you've got everything. Let's be real. That business should be one of your thriving diamonds. It should generate revenue awesomely. I can't wait to get up there, and see. And we're going to shoot a couple of Fishing Canada television show episodes up there this year, yep, which I'm very excited about.
Yeah, me as well.
Yeah. And folks, Craig and I are working together, right now through Diaries and Obabaka Lake Lodge. And, Craig has been gracious enough to donate another trip that somebody out there listening is going to win. So, it's something that you guys can take advantage of too. Even if you're in a position where you can't afford to do something like this, go to the Fishing Canada website and get on to the giveaways. We do wonderful work there, and a trip to Obabaka Lake Lodge is one of them. So hey, if you're listening to this and you're not recent on it, well, go to the website anyway. There's always giveaways, but for all of you who are up to date, good for you, because you're going to be able to take advantage of this giveaway, which is going to start next week, which is the first week of March. Actually it'll go live in a couple of days. So head over there, because it's going to be an unbelievable experience. And I think I read too, Craig, on the Lake Obabaka Lodge website, do you have access to the outpost lakes with speckled trout?
Yeah, we do. We have boats at all those lakes parked there, and we send you in with a little 2.5 motor to portage in, and the boats are all there. And there's a couple of lakes where you go in there and you really got to see it. Like the one lake that's, the watercolor is as blue as can be. It almost looks like you're in the tropics. And the interesting thing is that the entire lake is completely forested right to the shoreline. There's really nothing there. Like it's something everybody needs to see, because really what it is what the lakes were like before, you know, man came along, and it hasn't changed. So there's a few of those. There's also lakes around us that if somebody decided they want to drive through, they're close by. But to be honest with you, by the time you get there fishing and you're catching
as many fish as I think
you're going to
catch.
Sound like you've got to go far at all. Like, I mean, why would you leave Lake Obabaka or any one of these little outpost lakes?
Yeah. I think at the end of the day, what you look forward to is a really good meal and maybe a nice cold beer or a glass of wine and talk about your day and then get back out there the next day or just decide to sit in the beach and catch the waves because the beach is quite nice there as well, which is nice for kids and swimming and stuff like that. So
for sure.
Yeah, no, I think it's going to be a gem. It's just, because it was mothballed, it just takes a bit of time, as you know, just like it was with you. Like, you didn't open up the next year you bought it, Steve, and everybody came. You had to prove to them that you'd improved upon the place. Now I have to create some awareness, which is obviously, which I think we'll do well with the show. I think we'll get some people out there and say, wow, this is cool. These guys are having a great time and catching some great fish.
Yeah. Like I say, I'm truly excited about it. And even though I haven't been there yet, I keep referring back to my buddy Nolan. And Nolan, he's a great angler, wonderful friend of mine, goes up there with a group of guys that I know. And he just raves about everything. And, you know, hey, if it's good enough for Nolan, man, he's one of them honest dudes. So I just can't wait to experience it myself.
Yeah. But Nolan's a big fan. He's a great ambassador. The very first time Nolan came up there, he came over, they had dinner and there it was dark and he sat in my picnic table at the back of my cottage there. And one of the guys said, what's that over there? Is that like North Bay or something like that? And I said, no, that's the Northern Lights. We sat there and watched the Northern Lights for 2 hours. It was wild.
Awesome.
It was amazing. And it was kind of a, you know, it was a great impression on a guy that came there for his first time. And now he comes back every year.
Oh, for sure he does. I know. He's been on me to come back every year, but summer is typically a fairly busy time for me. But this year I'm going to be there and I'm excited to be.
Interrupt this program to bring you the much anticipated bonus code for the latest Diaries of a Lodge Owner giveaway. This week's code is Obabaka. That's capital O B A B I K A. Just type that in the bonus code section of the contest and receive 100 entries towards our Lake Obabaka Lodge giveaway. For those who aren't entered, what are you waiting for? Head over to fishingcanada.com while you listen to the rest of this episode. Click contests and sign up for all the latest Fishing Canada giveaways. Now back to the episode.
Now that we've talked about all of the stuff that you've got going on, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you this question.
Yeah.
How do you balance your home life with all of these businesses going on? I've been lucky enough to meet your wife, Jenny, and your beautiful daughters and they're still very young. How do you balance that?
Well, I mean, it's a bit of a challenge, but you know, the way I look at it is this, Steve, we typically, as you know, in our business, we open May 24. You're up there before May 24, but you're permanently there from May 24th till Thanksgiving. So there's about a month and a week before school ends, and there's probably a month and a half when school starts that I'm not in direct contact with the kids and Jenny. But I'm here all winter long. Like, I'm Mr. Mom here in the winter. I pick them up from school. I drop them off for school. I'm around all the time. So when you look at it as a parent, and I look at my previous life in sports consulting, if I get eight and a half months of pure nonstop, because the kids come with me in the summertime, they're with us all summer. If I get eight and a half months with my kids that's uninterrupted, that's probably better than most parents get that have two jobs and, you know, work late this night or travel. As a consultant, I'd never see him. I'd see him at graduation because I'm on the road nonstop. Yeah. So it's not perfect, but I think that the reward there is the experience my kids get growing up at that lodge, getting to know the people, getting to know the outdoors is so much better than them being in the city all the time on their screens and doing the other stuff. Yeah. I think I grew up, my dad sort of got me in, and I think I get my kids into it. And I think that, you know what, someday you might see my kids run on my lodges. They love it. They love the outdoors. They love to swim. So it's not perfect. And Jenny falls in the same thing. Jenny has her own clinic, but you know, the summertime she takes time off to come up with me and it works out well. And I think that, the quantity is actually better than what I get in my previous life.
Yeah, that is very well said. And that's awesome, because what you're doing and for me, being in that business and understanding the gratification that you feel when you can provide a service that so many people love and come in contact with so many great people, because a fishing lodge or a northern resort, it attracts a certain type of person. And 99.9% of those people are great people to start with. And my kids to this day still talk about the lodge. And when we come up to the cottage, they always want to go, can we go over to Chaudière and see how it looks and this and that? And, you know, it is a wonderful way to spend your time as a child. And good for you. That is wonderful. And the more time you can get those kids up there, the better.
Yeah, listen, when they're old enough to work the docks, they will. I'll get some free labor out of them, maybe. You never know. And you know, like, right, I would just say, Steve, if your dad said to you when you were 10 years old, I'm buying a fishing lodge and you got to spend all summer up there, you'd be packed before he finished the sentence. You'd be like, let's go.
Oh, for sure I would.
So I think that most kids would probably feel the same way. So I think it's great that you had the chance and I have the chance now to show our kids a different way of life.
Well, that's well said. And listen, I want to thank you so much for the time that you've given us. You are a man of many men. I'll tell you what, your experiences in life are truly interesting. And this won't be the last time that we get together for this. So I'd love to have you on at some time in the future. And I look forward to working with you over the next 6-8 weeks or whatever it might be, and then getting up there in the summer. And for all of you folks out there listening, thanks for making it this far. And I just wanted to thank you for all of them as well, Craig.
I'm glad to be on it. I look forward to seeing you in the summertime, wetting the line together.
Absolutely. And we're going to be at the Sportsman Show too. So if you're kicking around, stop in.
I'll be there.
Nice. And again, folks, thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate it. And if you like the content, if you like me, if you like what's going on, just leave the 5 stars, comments are always great, especially on Apple Podcasts. You can go on and leave a review. That all helps. That keeps the wheels turning around here. So, and don't forget to check out the giveaways on fishingcanada.com. And thanks again, folks. This brings me to the conclusion of another episode of Diaries of a Lodge Owner.
I'm a good old boy, never meaning no harm. I'll beat all you ever saw. Been reeling in the hog since the day I was born. Bending my rod, stretching my line. Someday I might own a lodge and that'd be fine. I'll be making my way the only way I know how. Working hard and sharing the north with all of my pals. Well, I'm a good old boy. I bought a lodge and lived my dream. And now I'm here talking about how life can be as good as it seems. Yeah.
What brings people together more than fishing and hunting?
How about food?
I'm Chef Antonio Maleca, and I have spent years catering to the stars. Now, on Outdoor Journal Radio's Eat and Wild podcast, Luigi, Hookset, and I are bringing our expertise
and Rolodex to our real passion, the outdoors.
Each week, we're bringing you inside the boat, tree stand, or duck blind and giving you real advice that you can use to make the most out of your fishing game.
You're going to flip that duck breast over once you get a nice hard sear on that breast. You don't want to sear the actual meat.
And it's not just us chatting here. If you can name a celebrity, we've probably worked with them. And I think you might be surprised who likes to hunt and fish.
When Kit Harrington asks me to prepare him sashimi with his bass, I couldn't say no.
So whatever Taylor Sheridan wanted, I made sure I had it.
Burgers, steak, anything off the barbecue. That's a true cowboy.
All Jeremy Renner wanted to have was lemon ginger shots all day.
Find Eating Wild now on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you get your podcasts.
Escape to the wilderness of Lake Obabaka Lodge, where the exclusivity of a fly-in meets the accessibility of a drive-to destination. Cast its pristine waters teeming with trophy lakers, northern pike, and smallmouth bass. Discover a paradise rich with history, offering serene moments and adventurous days. Lake Obabaka Lodge is where memories are hooked and history comes alive. Join us where the wilderness whispers your name.